Hello, everybody, and welcome back to an all-new Now Europe with Alicia and Josh. And today, we are going to be breaking down the barn burner that was Wales versus Belgium. Before we get in the game, Alicia, I just want to kind of like drift back to our previous conversation about how we thought this game could go. And, you know, it had occurred to both of us that Wales were just as capable of catching Belgium on the counter as Belgium were capable of catching Wales. And in many ways, it sort of felt like Wales were a bit more set up to get things off a little bit quicker in terms of getting the counter started by virtue of their positioning against the Belgians. When you looked at that lineup, I don't begrudge the fact that Wilmots had to start, you know, Denayer and Jordan Lukaku. Like, once you get to, you know, where he's at with the number of injuries that they have along the back line, you know, Denayer is certainly not a world beater, but he doesn't suck. How did you feel about starting 11 with Belgium?
Yeah, Belgium, like you said, they're put in a really tough position because of the yellow card accumulation, because, they came into the tournament without the defense that they necessarily wanted to field. And so at a certain point, there's nothing you can do, and you just sort of have to throw those players in there and hope that they are able to handle the pressure of it. And, you know, when they don't, you can't say it's all that shocking. Throwing Denayer into this game was real, like, it was very much a cross your fingers and hope he doesn't get burned too often kind of situation. And you know, in the end, he didn't have a particularly great game, but it's like, I just felt like the defense as a whole probably wasn't, like Alderweireld got made a fool of as well, and there were just moments where the entire collective in there really weren't on top of their game.
I believe Alderweireld was the guy who got taken to class by Aaron Ramsey, right?
Yeah, on the Robson Kanu goal. Yeah,
yeah,
that was him, and you know, so you can sort of see it from the perspective of, well, I mean, you can blame it all on the youth and inexperience and just guys getting thrown into the lineup, but that shakes up the whole thing. So even if they were, you know, even if those guys like stepped up a level, the whole defense is all about chemistry when it comes down to it. And you lose the back line that you've been working with this whole time, it can throw you for a loop, which is why I think, you know, looking at this game, when you're dealing with that defensively, it's really important that you then go out and score more than one goal. And that one goal can't be a 13th minute, like, worldie from Nainggolan. Like, you know, you get that goal, that's great, but you still have the firepower to go out there and get the second, the third goal, you know, if not the fourth goal. And there were some moments where you just looked at it and went, like, how in the world did Belgium not score? Fellaini missed an open header. There was a sequence where
Fellaini
was
garbage, dude. Like, Fellaini's
always
just
garbage.
Like, he did nothing for that side. Like, I struggled to find one thing that Fellaini did aside from take a perfectly valid attacking option off the pitch and replace him with somebody who clearly had no idea what he was doing today. So, I you know, I've always tried to be fair and critical of Manchester City players in this tournament, and Kevin De Bruyne was just absolutely ass-tastic today. I mean, I don't think I've seen De Bruyne that bad in set pieces or just overall ball placement, passing. De Bruyne was just over hitting everything, turning it over left and right. I mean, that's not to say that anybody else is doing a bang up job, but
right. But he's too good of a player.
Yeah.
To be that off, and I think you can level that same criticism at Hazard not making enough of an impact. So it's not that these aren't great players; it's that for one reason or another, they just didn't come at the level that you would sort of expect them to go out there and fight for a result. Where you saw the Welsh players just, you know, fighting and grasping and you know, doing everything that was in their power, and Belgium has all these great players, and it's why they were picked, you know, as favorites in this tournament. But for one reason or another, they're lacking something when it comes to their national performances.
I believe the phrase you were looking for is an intelligent manager. An intelligent manager was the phrase that you were looking for there.
That might contribute to it.
I just have nothing to say about Wilmot other than he just needs to resign, like, immediately after. Like, much like Roy Hodgson, just, guys, I'm not the right guy for the job. I think it's time for somebody else to take over. Like, this Belgian team is just way too good. There's just way, way, way too much talent for this team to be this utterly inconsistent and underwhelming just in every major tournament during this golden age, man. Like, I realize that a couple of these players are still 1 or 2 years away from hitting their peak, but you should start to see some of those flashes bursting through and occasionally making a deep run into a tournament, but it's just really not happening for Belgium, you know? I mean, it's just the hitherto thou shalt come, but no further, you know? It's just they can't seem to get over the mental hump of the quarterfinal stage, and I look at that roster and think to myself, A, just about everybody on that roster at one time or another is misused out of position. Like, I think the only person on that roster who's been currently used appropriately since the word go has been Thibaut Courtois. Like, that's it.
And it's a little bit tough to misuse your goalkeeper.
So I feel like this Belgian team was never really, like, you know, I mistakenly picked them last podcast, but I think I said I had zero confidence in, you know, like, I just,
yeah,
this is exactly what I knew could happen And you just felt maybe after that Hungary game that Belgium had finally got it going, but it's starting to look more like what you hinted at, is that Hungary had sort of reached their zenith already, and Belgium just ended their run. You know, it's sort of like the boss that beats you when you're on your last life. Like, it was eventually going to happen.
Right.
Matter just depends on which level, which round.
Yeah, and like we talked about last time, I think we both expressed this, that we wouldn't be, like, you could have told me yesterday the result was going to be 3-1 to Wales, and I would have gone, yeah, I could see that happening. I suppose so. And again, we're talking about another game, another team where they go behind early and they just fight back into the game. And I put this up on Twitter, that this is the classic scored too early situation, where Belgium gets their goal, they sort of take their foot off the gas a little bit, Wales grows into the game, gets their goal back, and then just dominates the rest of the half because they had grown into the game and they had already sort of wrestled control. And I mean, to be fair, Wales' second goal, the go-ahead goal, comes a little bit against the run of play because Belgium had come out in the second half and looked like they were the attacking impetus was on them a little bit more, and they continued after that. It looks like they might have gotten an equalizer at some point, but this is kind of what happens when you're toothless and your players aren't finishing their chances, like I talked about earlier. Then you sort of give away the 85th minute goal, you know, against the run of play, just from great, just both of those goals in the second half from Wales were just great quality attacking goals. And, you know, you can't say enough about the delivery from Ramsey or Robson Kanu, just that perfect touch and the turn that just fakes out the defenders and the finish. I mean, it was kind of an unstoppable goal, even though I don't know that Belgium's defenders did particularly well in that instance, but that kind of thing will happen to you. You need to go back and get your own goals and take your own chances. And that's just not what Belgium did. And, you know, I have plenty of criticisms for the manager as well. You know, again, I acknowledge that I am a Liverpool homer and maybe there's something that I'm not getting or not seeing, but to me, like, Divock Origi didn't get used in either of these last two games for them, and I would have had him on the pitch because I think he's an impact player. And when things aren't going your way, I think he's the kind of guy who can come on and make things change. But instead, you know, they persist with Fellaini and those kind of players who I don't know that they've earned the
like if Fellaini. Use. If Fellaini said, "I am Groot," following an interview, like, I would not at all, like, be surprised. I'd be like, "Oh, he is Groot. Okay."
Yeah, I mean, I have issues with Fellaini. I have a built-in dislike for him, just I try to be fair, but I can't. And then he goes and dyes his hair like that, and it's just like, "Well, see, you proved me right. You're terrible." But yeah, it was a game that played out a lot, very similar to how I thought it would play out, even though I predicted Belgium to win, because I think there was an alternate universe where Belgium, where, you know, Hazard has a moment of brilliance, or De Bruyne plays up to his standards, or, you know, Robson Kanu doesn't act like he's frickin' Messi and do that and score that way. So, but this is why you play the games. This is why this tournament is so fun. And now we're, you know, we've got Wales and Portugal in a semifinal in this tournament. And tomorrow, this weekend, we're going to get some really interesting matchups between Italy and Germany, which is, like we've talked about, sort of the final before the final. And
we've got one half of the semifinal that everybody predicted.
Yeah, well, I mean, are you talking about on this side where Wales and Portugal are the?
Oh yeah. We've got one half of the final that everybody predicted. You know, it's gonna, and I'm sure that when tomorrow delivers, you know, Iceland and tomorrow's Italy, Germany. I'm sure that when tomorrow delivers Italy via penalty shootout and then Iceland via a last-minute winner against France, like,
world's
going to be the best
going,
soccer
like,
ever.
I put this on Twitter as well. Like, I am fervently rooting for Wales-Iceland final. I think that would just be so much fun. And I at this point, you know, I generally just root for chaos. But chaos this tournament has provided. And I've seen people complain about the quality of the tournament and whether or not it's been entertaining. I've been really entertained. And more than anything, to me, this just is a validation of the format, of expanding the tournament, letting the little guys in, and seeing what they can do. Because look at them. They're romping through this thing. It's glorious.
Yeah, I think any notion that the little guy is getting in was ridiculous has basically been shattered. Like, I mean, expanding the tournament has only added to the excitement. It certainly created far more interest in the Euros because how many people who aren't normal fans are latching onto this Iceland story saying, all right, guys, let's do this, you know? And it doesn't matter how you get viewers or how you get somebody, you know, to love the game. They just have to see the game the way that they need to see it in order to fall in love with it. And if it's Iceland that does that, then so be it. You know, Iceland have more than acquitted themselves at these Euros. Like, it does not matter what they do. They can win this thing, and it just doesn't matter. Like, I mean, it would be the most awesome thing in the world if they won it, but it would already just be like, well, you know, there's not a lot that Iceland could do at this point that could sort of, like, up the ante. Like,
they've already done the most awesome thing in the world.
Yeah, you know, dumping England out on their head is as far as social media goes, is just amazing. But I want to look ahead very briefly before we get to a little bit heavier topic that may take up a little bit more time, and we're trying to do a truncated version here because there are plans. Yeah. But speaking of yeah, let's talk about those Germans versus the Italians. What do you think is going to end up happening tomorrow? I mean, is this Italian train going to keep on rolling? Or, there's just so many different things you can use as an analogy for Germany. You just always have to think,
the machine.
Is this one the wisest analogy that I could use? But yes, very, very much the machine. Is the machine just going to roll over the Italian? Because I'm starting to think Antonio Conte has tricked a whole bunch of people.
I picked Germany when we first did our predictions for this round. But the more that these results come in, the more chaos and random crap and team spirit ball happens and wins, like, the more I'm sitting here just thinking, well, I mean, the trends in this tournament tell me that Italy's going to get through this thing. Like, the trending in this tournament says that Germany can't possibly live up to the expectations that are on them for this round. I also feel like that's probably jinxing it, and that by saying that, Germany's probably going to win, but I'm definitely overthinking it that way. I think it'll be an extremely close, hard-fought match, and it wouldn't surprise me if it just sort of came down to a wonder goal, that somebody will just, you know, let fly from 35 yards out. And we'll be sitting there stunned, and it'll just be, and that'll be the difference in the game. And I couldn't tell you which side will do it, because again, chaos is reigning, and I can absolutely see arguments for either one of these teams going through. I'm more confident in Italy's team play. I'm more confident in Germany's star power. But that, you know, the way that this tournament has worked is that team play has trumped star power. So if I was going to do a revised sort of prediction, I'm leaning Italy right now. I really am.
Yeah, I think that when you look at what have been the pitfalls for some teams, is that no matter how good they've looked, And you can toss Belgium into this. Belgium got better after, you know, every game they played until they lost. But when you look at how Belgium fared as a patchwork team, really playing a whole bunch of people out of position, that is not too dissimilar from what Yogi Löw and Germany are doing. For all the glory and wonderfully talented skill players that Germany produces, a whole no of them play up front, and the other not of them play fullback. And we saw how that became a problem for Belgium, today. But you look at some of these patchwork teams and some of the holes that are then exposed as a result of having to use guys horrifically out of position or who are very clearly not whatever position they're playing, it just sort of makes you second guess as to whether or not this German team are as good as advertised, or if maybe they just got a decent draw in Slovakia, but once they hit up against an Italian team that's firing on all cylinders and playing lockdown defense, are they going to have that same moxie, or are we going to see something similar to what we saw today out of Belgium, where maybe the Germans get on the board, but then the Italians just come back and dominate the game and go on to win?
Oh, if somebody scores within the first 15 minutes, they're losing. Basically, if Germany scores in the first 15 minutes, they're losing. Italy, you know, our theme of the podcast has been Italy defending 1-0 leads. But, the scored too early phenomenon has been very much alive and well in these knockout rounds. So, yeah, basically it's the death knell. If you score within 15, you're dead in the water.
Yeah, and I don't know. I'm not convinced by maybe some of the substitutions that Germany have available to them. And while I realize that Italy might not be carrying the most loaded team, it really appears at this point that they understand Conte's system. And that's not to say the Germans don't understand Yogi Löw's system, because very clearly they do. But when you have a team full of players designed to be playing in that position going up against a team, no matter how good they are, with players playing in positions not designed for them, you're going to see pockets of space and mistakes and things of that nature, just simply because the individual that's supposed to be handling the role is not used to doing it. I mean, it's human nature. It's like going to your first day on the job. You're going to make a mistake, and you're going to have to ask someone how to help you fix it or whatever the case may be. And I feel like in the knockout stages, these margins for error just get more and more slender. And if Italy go up on Germany, I'm not at all convinced that Germany has this amazing striker that's going to unlock Italy.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that's going to be the big question asked of Germany. It's the same question that was asked of Spain, and Spain failed that test. You need somebody to step up and unlock this defense, because the one thing you can depend on is Italy and their defense showing up. So it's a test, and you know, Germany could very well do it, but putting like money on it right now, I don't know. That's asking a lot for me, having just watched all of these games. And seeing the way that everything else is playing out, it would almost be an aberration at this point if Germany were to come out and be able to really capitalize on their firepower against a very, very organized and well-drilled Italy team. They have their work cut out for them. But, I mean, this is why Germany was a favorite in this tournament. So they just have to go out and produce the big moment. And that'll get them through.
And with that, I just want to move on before we get out of here to sort of talk about some of the scapegoating that has occurred as a result of England being dumped on their head out of the tournament. And one article written yesterday by The Sun, I mean, that thing was just garbage. That was just racist garbage. Pointless. Like, I mean, the article literally had nothing to do with the Premier League other than the author's conjecture was that he wanted to be rich like Premier League stars, and then that would give him an excuse to show a picture of Raheem Sterling buying a house. You know, because everybody wants to crap on Raheem Sterling flossing with a new house, even though, oops, that house is for moms.
Yeah, that I saw you tweeting about that. It was, I mean, the Sun are a rag and should be treated as such, and that just sort of is par for the course for them as far as I'm concerned. This morning I did wake up and see a lot of the Liverpool people that I follow on Twitter were sharing this article from joe.co.uk that was talking about the sort of racist undertones and overtones that sort of sneak in or are blatantly produced when you talk about as far as criticism of a player like Raheem Sterling. They reference that particular Sun feature, and basically they just straight up tag it as racist. But they also bring up some other concerning sort of trends that happen when you're talking about these black players, about just the way that they're treated when they spend money, the way that they're treated when they ask for more money. When Raheem Sterling asked for time off from the England team, when he asked for Hodgson for a break, he got branded as lazy. And you know, when he talked about getting psychiatric help to deal with like the pressures of being in the Euro squad, he was tagged as soft. It really like having, you know, Raheem Sterling came up from sort of the Liverpool side of things. So I've really been exposed to this for a long time, and there has been talk, you know, going back to even before his shakeup with Liverpool and all that, about the way that he has been sort of, his public image has been sculpted, and how it just, it makes me and it makes a lot of other people uncomfortable the way that he's talked about sometimes, because, you know, you do see a difference in the belovedness of like a Raheem Sterling, or even like from my perspective, a Daniel Sturridge. Daniel Sturridge should be a Liverpool legend at this point, considering the goals that he scored and the rate that he scored them at. And, you know, there's other things playing into why Liverpool hasn't fully embraced him. But I've always looked at it and thought, like, why didn't Raheem Sterling have a song at Liverpool? Why doesn't Daniel Sturridge have a song at Liverpool? Why are they treated as selfish and arrogant and lazy when both of those players, I mean, you've now been watching Sterling closely at City. Like, I don't think tagging him as a lazy player is a fair just observation from what I've seen him when I've seen him play. Like, he is not lazy. He's not a perfect player, but to try and like act like he's this like, you know, never show up and just don't try and don't care kind of mentality, that's just not something that is a fair way to tag this guy. But he gets that tag, and I think there's a lot of reasons for it. But this particular article talks about the toxicity that creeps in there, and a lot of it, you have to wonder, is how much of this is, you know, if not overt racism, then either just, you know, subconscious or institutional or whatever it is, just the way that that we associate these players with certain traits that don't seem to quite fit if you were to try and look at another player in that way. I don't know if you see it the same.
Yeah, it certainly looks like some of these things are rooted with I don't know if you want to call them subtle or and subversive, however you want to hack it. It feels like these things, like you're writing that article about a dude who got busted for drugs. Why is a picture of Raheem Sterling being used in there, like, as an example of football players flashing their cash? Like, he bought his mom a house. That is in no way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
Like, no. No, just no, just no, just no. Like, and the editor should have killed that. And it's...
He's allowed to spend his money.
Like, it's shit like this. That, and I'm going to call out the douche in Manchester, because I think it's always better to call out your own fan base on stuff like this than other people's fan bases. But the douche in Manchester that was talking to an African on the tram and telling him, "We voted you to leave, now get the hell out of here." And the guy got beer tossed on him and a beer bottle thrown at him. And he'd actually been in the country longer than that kid had been alive, and was saying, like, "I've served in Her Majesty's Army. What are you, a punk, like, 16-year-old? Like, get the hell out of here. Like, you don't even know what you're talking about." And this piece of trash, you know, just continued on with his babbling, you know, supremacist nonsense. And the train ganged up on him and threw him out and whatnot, and he got arrested. But it's garbage like the crap that you read in the Sun, where people get the idea that it's okay to just make those distinctions, make those delineations, associate every black player with every negative stereotype. Like, it's all a sack of garbage, dude. It really is. It's all the biggest sack of crap in the world, and you're absolutely right about the subtle tones of racism there. It's gone on too long, and I truthfully think that FIFA has done... And this isn't even FIFA, I guess it's UEFA. And really, UEFA has a huge problem with it. That's not to say they're the only nation with a problem with it, but they certainly got a huge problem with it, just with racism.
Well, what's concerning is, like, you know, I think pretty much everywhere in the world deals with these kinds of racial divides or ethnic divides, whatever you want to call it. But what's concerning is that in the civilized world in 2016, that there are still these blatant instances of just straight up bigotry and hatred and sort of us versus them mentality. And yeah, soccer becomes a sort of an unfortunate focal point for some of these things, because you get these, you know, public figures, you get these, you know, rabid fans who are, you know, maybe have had too much alcohol and that loosens their inhibitions and they just start spouting out nonsense. But I mean, even that is more acceptable than, like, a publication choosing. These are people who are being paid to choose the photo on the cover story for this thing, and they pick one of Sterling, and like, it's just the blatantness of it all is what concerns me the most, because I accept that these are problems that humans deal with, and it's going to be a constant battle that we're fighting, but I just wish we were farther the frick along than we are in terms of accepting each other and not being hateful, spiteful kind of people.
Alas, douches reign supreme. But, you know, hopefully this stuff just, you know, we find a way to address this stuff as we move into the future. Hopefully a little bit of self-policing is involved, as there were at these Euros. And more importantly, just hopefully it these sorts of things get stamped out of the game. You know, it probably won't.
We can dream.
Unfortunately, any time you're playing a sport that is designed to instill national pride, sort of byproduct of that is my nation is better than yours, and it's not that much of a jump from my nation is better than yours to my people are better than yours. You know, I mean, so I'm not saying that we should stop international sports because it's going to lead to racism. I just think that we have to understand there's always going to be a small percentage of the culture with the, you know, brains the size of peas who are going to see that nationalist side of things and use that as a reason to do very horrible and awful things. And that just seems to be the case no matter where you live, what you love, and who you support. And it's not just football. So, you know, hopefully fans and the leagues do their best to stamp this out. And if more and more games have to be played behind closed doors, I got to be honest, man. From as a viewer on television, I kind of enjoy it. Like, I get to hear everything that's going on the pitch, and that's a lot different than I'm very much used to, you know? So it can be cool in its own regard. And I understand that it's less than ideal for the network showing the game, but, you know, I think at the end of the day, nobody's going to turn the game off and say, you know, I really wanted to watch that Inter Milan Liverpool Champions League final, but they were playing it behind closed doors, and I feel like it took away from the experience of the game. Oh, all right, sure. You know,
well,
and if they do, fine.
Well, I mean, and at a certain point, you just have to do what you can to discourage this kind of behavior.
AC Milan, Liverpool.
Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah, people will watch the games wherever you play them, whatever broadcast you put them on. It's just about, you know, we've talked a couple times now about the, you know, different countries who have a lot of these cultural problems that really manifest in their soccer support. And, you know, you look at countries who have had to do games behind closed doors because of fan behavior. And, you know, racial issues like this should be something that get you that level of punishment. And unfortunately, like, just because it's unpleasant to you know, have to deal with behind closed doors games, if that's going to be the thing that gets people in line, then you just sort of have to do it. And you have to sort of live through the punishment to see a better day later because it fixes the problem, or at least fixes some of the problem.
In theory. But we move on to the other side of the bracket tomorrow. So that leaves us with a perfect place to bail out and call it. Tomorrow should be boatloads of fun with what I think is going to be the best game of the tournament. Unless, of course, one of the teams from the bunk side or Iceland win this thing, which I suppose is very possible. I think it's best to leave it there and revisit. I mean, we're just going to have so much to talk about after Germany, Italy. I feel like the world will open up as our oyster. Especially with the score.
Exactly.
If the score is significantly in favor of either Italy or Germany, we'll know that those teams have arrived. That's sort of the consistency and outstanding performances that you look for as a team that's caught fire late in these competitions. And if Italy or Germany pull out another 3 or 4 goal game, you're like, all right, well, I can likely stop watching the rest of this tournament and still be right about who wins. Of course, I'm not going to do that. But you could. Yeah, but you could. To be honest, I'm kind of excited for the third place game.
Oh, the third place game is going to involve one of Wales, Portugal, or something fun. Like,
yeah,
I think Wales would go balls out for a third place game. I'd have some fun with that at least.
In a world where you know, if Iceland were to somehow get through tomorrow or on Sunday against France, that would just be that would almost guarantee us a Wales-Iceland game of some kind.
Yep, and it'll be exceedingly exciting.
All right, well, I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up there. Once again, she is Alicia De Artola, and you can find her on Twitter at Penguin of Troy. You can find me on Twitter at Fight On Twist. I have also started a brand new podcast with my buddy Gray Patke called American Citizens. And it is a distinctly American look at Manchester City. And we try to have fun there. So you should definitely come and check us out. We are as critical of the team as we are of each other. But with that, we will be back probably again tomorrow to discuss the results of yet another European game. They're getting fewer and fewer, but we will be here to cover each and every one. So for Alicia, I am Josh, and we will catch you next time here on Now Europe with Alicia and Josh.